Hello, I'm Rosie Goldsmith, and it's good to be back with you again, back after a long, cold, wet winter with our bright and beautiful spring podcast from the Slightly Foxed office here in London, where you'll be able to hear everybody is hard at work. Before we start, I'm sure you're curious to know what Slightly Foxed has been up to over the winter and what's in store over the next few months. So here with me are the two very brilliant women pulling all the strings, the editors and publishers of Slightly Foxed, Gail Perkis and Hazel Wood. What news? And you know I mean brilliant, with all my heart and sincerely. So it's great to see you both again.
That's very kind of you, Rosie.
Gail.
Well, we've been getting the summer issue and the summer book ready. And the summer book is an incredibly moving account of a prisoner of war of the Japanese who worked on the Burma-Siam Railway, called the Railway Man. And I find it particularly moving because at Changi, which was where a lot of the prisoners were kept in Singapore, there is a little museum with a chapel commemorating what these men went through. And if anybody has an opportunity to go there, I recommend it. But the book is, it's an extraordinary account of a man who goes through the most terrible time and is tortured hideously, but manages to achieve reconciliation 30 or 40 years later.
Who's it by?
Eric Lomax, and I do recommend it. And then the issue, we've gone quite watery and quite American this summer. So there's a lovely piece on Arthur Ransome's Peter Duck by the very fortunate woman who actually owns the boat that Ransome had built, which is the model. It's called PD, short for Peter Duck. A beautiful piece on Richard Jeffries' nature writing, something on the Grapes of Wrath, something on a book about poker by Al Alvarez, Valley of the Dolls by Jacqueline Suzanne. So there's lots of variety, quite a lot of travel, quite a lot of going to
It sounds like a really,
far off places.
Really good thing to do, yeah. Focus on America. I mean, this is an antidote to all the other things that are happening.
Well,
from America.
Actually, one of the most moving pieces is about a book called The Summer in Suffolk by an American who was posted there during the war. And it records just how welcoming the British were to him. And in the light of Trump's recent activities and opinions, it's nice to see that a rather special relationship, you know, really did exist.
Hear, hear. Sounds brilliant. That word again. Hazel, your turn to be brilliant.
Well, it's spring, so it's the sort of literary festival season coming up. And in 3 days, on Saturday, Gail and I will be appearing at a new, small literary festival in London, in Barnsbury. It's called the Barnsbury Book Festival. And it's basically in aid of St Andrew's Church. And it's, you know, billed as having all sorts of talks on different things like cinema, books. And Gail and I will be appearing at 10 a.m. on Saturday. So if you're in the area, do drop in. So that's one thing. And the other thing, just to sort of a little reminder, that in the last issue we announced the Slightly Foxed Writers Competition. We've done this in the past, and we've come up with some really, really good contributions because Slightly Foxed readers, you know, they're not sort of hesitant with a word or two. So,
When is the deadline for that?
The deadline for that is the 1st of September. So you've got sort of the summer, really, to, you know, let it all flow. And we're looking forward to some really good contributions. And the first prize is £300 and appearance in the magazine. And then the two runners-up will be on the website. So do,
maybe one
know,
day on the podcast, you never know.
Yes, yes.
No, it's a fantastic writing competition. I wonder whether our guest is even thinking of entering. Is it anonymous? Or do you judge with names attached to the pieces?
We judge it by the quality of the writing.
Yes.
It's all that matters.
Yes, yes. In our
provenance,
laid-back and personal style.
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, thank you very much indeed, Gail and Hazel. Stay with us. Now, our spring podcast is dedicated to the remarkable British author, adventurer, travel writer, novelist and foreign correspondent Norman Lewis. He was born in Enfield, North London, in 1908 and died at the age of 95 in 2003 after travelling all over the world, notably to Indochina, India, Burma, Latin America, Spain, Sicily and Indonesia, writing 15 novels, maybe 20 travel books, although the numbers are contested, so we might discuss that later, and he wrote hundreds of newspaper articles. So why are we talking about Norman Lewis today? Well, for several reasons. We simply don't talk about him enough. Also, a superb collection of his writing, A Quiet Evening, has been published. And, very importantly, we have succeeded in pinning down his very busy friend and biographer, Julian Evans, to talk about Norman. Welcome to Julian. We have you in our grasp. We have you here.
Hello, Rosie.
It's great to see you. Now, I'm particularly excited about this episode, not only because I want to share my own Lewis love with you all, but because Julian is the best possible person to accompany us on this journey. Julian is himself a great traveller, which is why it's hard to pin him down, a writer and journalist. He has spent 25 years also visiting and writing about Ukraine, and his latest book, which I highly recommend, is called Undefeatable: Odessa in Love and War. And I hear the paperback is due out this month.
Coming out this month.
Go buy it, everybody. It really is fantastic. In 2008, Julian published A Semi-Invisible Man, a magnificent biography of Norman Lewis to mark the centenary of Lewis's birth. Julian, that question, why do you think that Norman Lewis is not better known? A nice, easy one.
Well, I think the answer's in the title of the biography, really. He was, in his literary persona, semi-invisible. That was his stock in trade, really. His shtick was to always be at a slight distance, on the outside, on the periphery, watching, producing those revealing little descriptions. Also, it's got to be said that apart from being able to do what he at one point described as a creditable amount of small talk, he loathed publicity.
How very refreshing to hear of an author who's not keen on publicity.
It's a bit of a nightmare for the publicist.
It is, but self-effacement, I think, is, you know, not a bad quality.
So, Julian, you met Norman Lewis the first time, 1981 or 1982, and you were a young editor with a publisher, and you were just about to start editing Norman's books. Tell me about your first impressions and what you made of him.
I worked for Hamish Hamilton, and the great, late, wonderful Christopher Sinclair Stevenson gave Norman a two-book contract. And with the generosity that I always remember with Christopher, he said, "You're going to edit these." And so we went to lunch at a long-defunct restaurant called The Grange in Covent Garden. And Norman arrived, tall, lanky, bespectacled, looking slightly furtive, but perhaps just shy, and then said nothing for the first 20 minutes. And Christopher asked him questions. I asked one or two questions. He gave very short answers, leaving long silences. And at one point, I remember Christopher looked at me, pushed his glasses up his nose and raised his eyebrows as if to say, "What on earth is this lunch turning into?" And then suddenly Norman decided that he trusted us, and the stories started to come, and then they started to pour out, and we just sort of sat there with our elbows on the table taking occasional bites of lunch, just in awe at his storytelling capacity. And that was one thing about Norman. Read the books, because the prose just falls off the page, but he was a great oral storyteller too. And even if you'd heard the story before, there would be something new each time. He was just a sort of Scheherazade, really. You always wanted to come back the next night for more.
So about your friendship, though, did you hit it off, as they say, right at the beginning? Did you fall in love at that first meeting, or how did that develop?
We met occasionally for editorial meetings, and then Norman would, he invited me up to, they were living in Cambridge, the family then, he invited me up to Cambridge for a lunch with him and his wonderful wife, Leslie. And then there was a point when he rang me up and he said, I'm in your area, would you like to meet me at Elvino's in Fleet Street at 5:30 when you finish work? So we went to Elvino's and had a drink, and that was kind of the beginning of it. That was when I realised that he, for some reason, you know, there I was, a sort of editorial zero, really. But he wanted to have a friendship, and that's where it started, and it went on for 16, 17 years after that.
Must have been.
Hazel.
I was just going to say, it must have been pretty daunting, you know, to be confronted with him. What was it like, you know, being his editor?
You mean working on the actual books?
Yes, working on the actual books. I was wondering what your relationship was like about that.
I edited about four of his books, yeah. And actually, he was really easy to edit, though I did, after a while, understand that his fantastically courtly politeness concealed any trace of irritation, of which I eventually surmised that there was sometimes some. So I started being really quite interventionist and working very closely on the text, and gradually I learned to let the text, you know, flow and go a bit more freely. But he left Hamish Hamilton when we had it wasn't really a disagreement, it was just a suggestion that one of his novels was so imbued with the sense of place that perhaps we should publish it as non-fiction. And I'm afraid it led Norman to say yes to one of the offers from other publishers that he was by then getting a steady stream of.
Had you read Norman Lewis before you met him? Had you already fallen in love with his writing?
No, I had no idea who he was. But I read, as soon as Christopher gave me the first book to edit, which was a novel called A Suitable Case for Corruption, I went and read Naples 44. And then I thought, right,
this is
I
it.
Know where I am
yes.
now.
Mm. Well, this is the best possible cue for our reading, because like you, I just love Naples 44, and that's what sealed it for me. Now, last year, an anthology of Norman Lewis's writing was published by his longtime champion and publisher John Hatt for Eland Books. The anthology is entitled A Quiet Evening and consists of extracts from Norman Lewis's very best work across 60 years, among them an extract from this travel writing masterpiece, Naples 44. Now, when he was in the intelligence corps of the British Army during World War II, he was sent to Naples for 18 months, and his observations of this destroyed city, of the poverty, hunger and despair, are unsurpassed. So we've now got an extract from Naples 44, read by Rose Baring, owner and co-publisher at Eland Books. Norman Lewis and an Italian friend, Latorullo, an impoverished lawyer, are visiting a makeshift restaurant.
Suddenly, five or six little girls between the ages of 9 and 12 appeared in the doorway. They wore hideous straight black uniforms buttoned under their chins, and black boots and stockings, and their hair had been shorn short, prison style. They were all weeping, and as they clung to each other and groped their way towards us, bumping into tables and chairs, I realised that they were all blind. Tragedy and despair had been thrust upon us and would not be shut out. I expected the indifferent diners to push back their plates, to get up and hold out their arms, but nobody moved. Forkfuls of food were thrust into open mouths. The rattle of conversation continued. Nobody saw the tears. Latarulo explained that these little girls were from an orphanage on the Vomero, where he had heard, and he made a face, conditions were very bad. They'd been brought down here, he found out, on a half-day's outing by an attendant who seemed unwilling or unable to stop them from being lured away by the smell of food. The experience changed my outlook. Until now, I had clung to the comforting belief that human beings eventually come to terms with pain and sorrow. Now I understood I was wrong, and like Paul, I suffered a conversion, but to pessimism. These little girls, any one of whom could be my daughter, came into the restaurant weeping, and they were weeping when they were led away. I knew that, condemned to everlasting darkness, hunger and loss, they would weep on incessantly. They would never recover from their pain, and I would never recover from the memory of it.
Hearing that reading, for me, I can just feel the compassion of Norman Lewis. Julian, tell us about the writing of Naples 44. What does it show us about Norman Lewis?
I think the first thing that we need to know about Naples 44 is that It was written in a parsonage in Finchingfield in Essex in the 1970s. And that Norman had never really written about his wartime service up until then, because he'd come out of the army after the war, and his friends had all said to him, "Oh, for God's sake, please spare us your memoirs," whenever he mentioned that he was going to carry on trying to be a writer. And so he sat down thinking that he would like to write something about Naples, and looked back over his notebooks.
So he had written copious notes and diaries on which he based.
I wouldn't say they were copious. He wasn't supposed to keep a notebook. Service personnel weren't, but he did. And actually, as I remember, it was in a little pocket address book, which he'd obviously sort of picked up somewhere.
Have you seen it?
Maybe confiscated. Yes. When I was writing the biography, I got hold of a few of those sort of original documents. But the point was that he found his form 35 years later after the event, and that once he'd worked out that it should be a diary, and that the story had the sort of trajectory of arrival, understanding, some despair, but a great deal of curiosity and fascination, and then the leaving, which gives you the end. He'd found the perfect form. And then I wouldn't say that it was easy for him to write. He did go back to Naples two or three times while he's writing it with an Italian friend to look over the scenes and places. But he had found his form with the diary. And in a sense, you know, I don't think he was pulling the wool over anybody's eyes, you know, because the notebook was just not a formal diary. You know, it was written chronologically.
Gail and Hazel, we've all read Naples 44 again for the podcast, and I wonder how you feel hearing about that, because the immediacy of this book about Naples, set in 1943, 1944, during the war, is absolutely extraordinary. Yeah. To write it in that form of a diary, as if we were there. That's what it feels like.
Absolutely, yes. Totally immediate. I suppose his diary was just a sort of a prompt, in a way, for everything that poured out.
I think that's exactly right. And I think that's another thing that made it work 35 years later, and would not have made it work if he'd written it after the war.
Because
he was, you know, in that sort of classic phrase, more or less at the height of his powers as a writer, and he knew how to do this. He knew how to access his imagination and his memory, combine the two together, and he developed his own, you know, his own sense of the world, which was slightly absurd, and his own sense of humour, which always had this very contemporary, still contemporary irony, you know. So that's why it kind of took off, but it didn't take off the first time when Collins published it in 1978. I mean, it, you know, it was well reviewed, but it took John Hatt's efforts 5 years later, I think it was, publishing it at Eland. And I think John is always very proud of this, so I don't mind repeating it. I think he got something like 130 mentions for the book in his efforts to kind of,
fantastic,
you know, rouse the literary editors, rouse radio, and Norman did end up doing Desert Island Disc, which is a lovely listen. Yes.
I'm sure I'm not the first to say, but hats off to John Hatt, because, I mean, great publishers, we really need them. We have a couple in our room as well, so we're very grateful. But that is fascinating. And I think the other thing, Julian, that really strikes me about Norman Lewis is his great love of Italy. What was the pull of Italy for Norman Lewis?
I think Norman found an ease to life there and a humanity. And I don't mean that as an abstract thing. The way any Italian, if you talk to them, will happily and immediately talk to you about food, sunshine, family, children, pleasure, wine, all those things. And there's a sort of unquestioning acceptance that those are the great things of life. I've always thought there was a lot of truth in the comparison between Spain and Italy, and I can't remember who came up with it. Said that in Spain you have a Catholicism which is the vessel of pain, and in Italy you have a Catholicism which is the vessel of pleasure. And I think that Norman was totally on board for that. And he did actually say, you know, were I able to have my life over again and choose the place of my birth, it would have to be Italy.
I actually agree with that. If Italy hadn't been invented, I would have to invent it. Now, at this stage, I'd like to, if you like, turn the clock back even further and look at Norman Lewis's early years and just really find out what drove him. He wrote his own biography, Jack Door Cake, in 1985, which I think you edited, didn't you, Julian?
I did.
You did. But in a nutshell, the facts of Norman's life are: his parents were Welsh, living in London, and they became severely depressed when his older brothers died, or all his older brothers died, three older brothers. Then they turned to spiritualism and his father to alcohol. In other words, turning away from their young son, Norman. So Norman did not come from a wealthy or privileged background, no Oxbridge, no mentors, but always had to strike out on his own to support himself and to later his family with his writing and all kinds of businesses. Photography, he was a great photographer. He sold cameras, cars, he drove cars.
Umbrellas.
He was certainly very enterprising. So writing, living and travelling were inseparable for him, I think. Now, Julian, how did his early life, do you think, influence his writing and why he even began writing? It wasn't a natural background.
No, it wasn't. I think you have to understand the severity of that Enfield childhood. If you go to the house now, you'll see that next door there is actually a spiritualist chapel, which his parents were responsible for establishing back in the 1910s. Then I think he was very badly bullied. He told me about this, and I think nobody knew about it until he sat down one day in an interview that I did with him for The Guardian. And he told me how the school inspector had said in front of the whole class at his primary school, how is the level of attainment generally among your pupils? And the head teacher had said, oh, we have one boy here, we don't have to teach at all. And that just put a target on Norman's back. And he was beaten up very badly. He used to get sort of dropped in icy ponds and hit with pieces of ice and all sorts of horrible things. So he had this quite rugged childhood in which he learned, and that's really where he learned it, to stand back, to be the outsider, to be always on the edge.
So not to draw attention to yourself.
Never to draw attention to himself. But of course, you know, everyone has to make sense of the world in their own way. And Norman was both quite daring, and he was always trying to understand what was going on around him. And he did that by starting to write. He was completely self-invented, as you say. I think he benefited from the fact in the 30s, if you wanted to get anywhere, the economic conditions were so bad that, you know, you really had to be quick on your feet and make yourself into whatever you could. And that's where the kind of, you know, the wheeling and dealing and the slightly Del Boy aspect to his early life came.
But his kind of dashing sense of adventure as well.
Oh, yes. I mean, you know, pinstripe suits, polka dot ties, camel hair coats.
Photos of him.
He looks like, you know, an out-and-out spiv in some of them.
Well, that's a little harsh.
But I meant in appearance, not in...
Yes, I mean, he certainly... I think that was perhaps even connected to his first marriage. And, you know, there was a bit of the Italian job about him at that time. And then, of course, he loved cars and motorbikes. Started on bikes and went on to cars. And was racing Bugattis at Silverstone just before the war. It was really weird that although he came from, you know, nowhere, I mean, he described Enfield as nothing with chips, he nevertheless had a real nose for quality. What were the cameras he sold? Leicas. He was one of the very first people to import and sell Leica miniature 35mm cameras.
And that camera shop actually continued to thrive for decades. Didn't it?
Yes, it did, yeah, yeah.
So how did all this transfer into the writing and the travelling? He started travelling at quite a young age, paying for himself, obviously. His work had to fund his travel.
Yeah, he went He went to Spain in the mid-30s with his wife's brother, and they had this kind of slightly Peter Fleming-ish, P.G. Woodhouse-ish adventure. They planned to canoe their way down the rivers of France into Spain. They got about 3 miles and had to ditch the canoe. I'm really sorry that Norman always refused to have that book republished, because it's actually got moments of...
That's the Spanish Adventure.
It's called Spanish Adventure.
And that's the one you actually want to try to republish.
I would love to republish it, yeah.
So he wrote, before the Second World War, he'd already written two books.
He had, yes. The second one was, well, that was interesting because a man called Rex, somebody or other, and it wasn't his real name, but he worked for the Foreign Office, came into the camera shop one day and said, would you like to go on a trip? And Norman said, try and stop me. And he sent him to the Yemen. And he was supposed to get into Yemen. And he went to Aden and tried to make his way into it. You know, and he'd never actually did it. But he did a sort of a photo travelogue with a short script, and that's called A Voyage by Dow, and that was published in 1937. And that hasn't been republished either.
Now, this does bring me to the question of whether he was a spy, because this is also tied in with the fact that he was an excellent photographer, an excellent observer, an excellent linguist, and also very well travelled. And he was, around that time, approached by the Foreign Office. Can you tell us a little bit more about that?
Well, I suppose you could say it kept happening, because after the Yemen episode, he went away with Ernestina, his wife, and their young son to Cuba, and then war broke out and he got into the intelligence corps, so he was sort of gravitating in that direction. And then after the war he bumped into Ian Fleming at a party, and Fleming immediately spotted that he was a person who would be useful, so he went and did some work, I think we can say, for Fleming, who, as well as being the Sunday Times' foreign editor, was also reporting back to his bosses in MI6. There's not very much I can sort of put my finger on, but there are one or two letters from sort of obscure addresses in Dulwich suggesting he go to places. And if the Sunday Times come up with the travel costs, I'm sure we can do something, kind of thing.
Because there's a remarkable...
Yeah.
Piece in the anthology where Fleming sends him off to Cuba to interview Ernest Hemingway, but also to assess how many Cubans are behind Fidel Castro, who's not yet in power. And it's only 4 or 5 pages, but it's obviously fascinating. And he rightly concludes that actually many Cubans are in favour of Fidel Castro, and that America's got it completely wrong, and they're trying to back the existing regime. Very perceptive.
And that... had the Americans not done that, Fidel Castro probably wouldn't have gone communist.
Okay, so first of all, we have established he did probably spy. That's not an issue, I don't think, but so many people did. I mean, it's almost in a way you think, you know, why is it so shocking?
Oh, it was our national industry, wasn't it?
Yes, it was a national industry. And I wonder, actually, Julian, while we're here, whether you could tell this wonderful anecdote about Ernest Hemingway and Norman Lewis meeting Hemingway.
Yes, he'd been asked by Fleming, not as part of the kind of geopolitical report that he was supposed to provide, but Fleming was very curious to see what Hemingway was up to in Cuba and what he was really like. And so Norman announced himself and requested a meeting, and Hemingway said, sure, come to the Finca. And he found Hemingway there in a really terrible, abject state. A man, you know, in pyjamas, drinking pint glasses of Dubonnet, and saying that he refused to talk about Cuba and Castro because he lived there, you know, he didn't want to upset his own position on the island. But Norman then wrote this wonderful paragraph about how it was as if the Sermon of the Vanities had been rammed down his throat by seeing this man who was probably the most successful writer in the world at the time, probably a man who could have had any woman he desired, and that he had been reduced by his vanity to this physical wreck, who within a year, or definitely within 2 years, had shot himself. And you know, Norman saw it as a very educational moment, and I think anybody who reads that and thinks, what is the meaning of fame? Do I want to be famous? It's a very educational moment.
I definitely saw it as a very educational moment reading that. Norman Lewis is very good at summarising why countries and people had a particular impact on him. And in fact, there's a really interesting quote which I wrote down about how important war was to him and to his writing, because he obviously thrived in those circumstances. And he wrote 50 years after the Second World War, he wrote, "The war was something fantastic. I hate cruelty of any kind. I'm a passionate person, but every minute of the war, all the time I was abroad, was absolutely paradise." So it's not as if he loved guns and, you know, shooting people and all the rest.
He did actually love guns.
He did love guns.
But he didn't like shooting people.
Okay. Well, that's a relief.
There was like trying to defend him on all the wrong counts. But so if we look at his style as well, which you've already alluded to several times, and now, you know, having read a lot, I can see that this spare and economical, slightly elusive man, you know, writing as he did, how would you sum it up? I mean, he was prolific. He was, you know, you wonder how on earth he did manage to write as much as he did. But how would you sum up his writing?
He was a crack shot, by the way, as well. How would I sum up his writing? I think if we go back to the beginning, he always said that he never had any access to modern rubbish. The books that he learned from were the books in the Carnegie Library in Enfield and the Bible. And he said the King James Bible is full of some of the most beautiful prose you will ever come across. And so at that point, he learned brevity. He learned the value of an unexpected adjective. He learned the importance of taking the reader on a little trip in each sentence. There are countless sentences in his work where you start a sentence and by the time you get to the end of it, you have to say to yourself, well, I had absolutely no idea that sentence was going to finish there. And he worked very hard at it. I mean, he was prolific, but he wrote in longhand almost all the time. And he had this fantastic and slightly hilarious literal cutting and pasting technique where he would make these sort of lengthy scrolls and then read them through and literally cut sentences out and then sellotape them somewhere else in the text or throw them away. And that was his craft for sort of sculpting the final version that Leslie would then type for him.
Now, you've mentioned a number of women. There were a number of women in his life, and Leslie is she's still alive. She was his third wife.
Leslie was his third partner. They did eventually get married. He didn't marry his second partner. And
he had children with all three women.
Oh, yes. Yes. Oh, yes. Yes, Leslie's still alive. In fact, I spoke to her on the phone last night. When they met, she was working for BOAC in London. And I think they met at a party Norman threw, and that was how it began. It took quite a long time. Norman worked very hard to persuade her to be with him, which is all to Leslie's credit, because Norman was a smooth operator. He had a flat at that time opposite Selfridges. And Norman threw these fantastic parties, some of which would end up with people doing target practice across the large,
with
long
guns.
Sitting room. With guns. Yeah.
So he absolutely loved guns.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. He loved the fun of that. And Leslie was 22 years younger than him. So she is amazingly and wonderfully still here. I've asked her in all sorts of ways, you know, what it was like. And she said, what I think I most loved about Norman was that I wanted to be educated, and he really educated me. And especially having the chance to do that with this very amusing, very interesting man across the table with a bottle of wine, she said, was a fantastic pleasure and a privilege.
I think I would have been one of the women who have fallen for Norman Lewis, definitely, especially when you write as well as he does as well, too. And we've spoken about the trips he did before the Second World War, during the Second World War, and then afterwards. How did he choose the countries he visited? I mean, were these commissions for journalism, or did he decide he wanted to write a book about a particular country and he went there?
He was an avid reader of newspapers. And he would always try and read behind what the foreign correspondents were saying. If he thought that there was something about to happen, he would take his opportunity and say to a publisher, I think that might be an interesting place to visit. Which, in the end, gave, if you like, the structure to what we now think of as his ability to be everywhere at the right time.
And prescient.
Yes, prescient, well. Of course, mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, he was, you know, his big success after the war, the first big success, was a book called A Dragon Apparent, Travels in...
Which is magical.
It's wonderful.
It? Yeah.
This is Travels in...
Travels in what we used to call Indochina, so Vietnam, Laos, Cambodia.
And before the Vietnam War, of course, which changed everything.
Well, the French were there.
Yes.
It is a wonderful book. And Norman already was a really good writer by that time. This is 1951. And the first page and a half of A Dragon Apparent, absolutely sublime prose. His arrival in a plane coming into land in Saigon.
Yeah.
And there was a French colonel sitting next to him. It's wonderful.
I remember that passage so well. Again, if we had chance for more readings, we'd definitely put that one in. We actually have got another reading, though, as well. And this is actually from British Honduras, another great reading. It's also in the anthology. And we'll talk more about Central and South America later, because that was another region he visited his whole life. So we have a reading from Rose Baring again from the anthology A Quiet Evening. It's 1955 and Norman Lewis has just arrived in British Honduras. And you probably remember this section as well when he talks about putting up at the hotel.
Little by little, the rich, homely, slightly dotty savour of British Honduras seeped through its protective walls to reach me. I began to take a collector's pride in such small frustrations as the impossibility of getting a double whisky served in one glass. Two single whiskies always came. Also, the architectural pretensions were much relieved by such pleasing touches as the showcases in the vestibule, which displayed, along with a fine Mayan incense burner in the form of a grotesque head, a few pink antlers of coral, odd-shaped roots, horns carved into absurd birds, and a detachable pocket made of pink shells, recommended as a chic addition to the cocktail frock. Part of the Fort George's charm arose from the fact that the staff, who spoke amongst themselves a kind of Creole dialect, sometimes had difficulty in understanding a guest's requirements. This went with a certain weakness in internal liaisons, and from the operation of these two factors arose many delightfully surrealistic incidents. At any hour of the night, for example, one might be awakened by a maid bearing a raw potato on a silver tray, or be presented with four small whiskies, a bottle of aspirin, and a picture postcard of the main facade of the capital's fish market, dated 1904.
Julian, he really was very funny and very witty, wasn't he?
His eye for the weird detail that seems to come from nowhere, and yet somehow managing to make it seem as if the whole of reality is made up of those elements. I mean, it's almost slightly knockabout, but there's a great elegance in the way that he says it. And again, it's that sort of the diction of the Bible. So it's presented in a serious way, but at the same time, he's undercutting it all the time with this absurdity, which is, I mean, I think it's timeless. I don't think it goes out of date at all.
He never overplays the humour, does he?
No.
The sort of secret of it is that it's just completely deadpan, as if this was a normal happening.
Yeah, not once.
So brilliant.
Yes. He always knows when to stop. How do you assess his interest in Central and South America? I mean, what was it about that region that attracted him?
there were several elements. One of which is that there's something to do with, you know, his love for Italy and Spain is carried over into Central and South America. I think he loved the, can I say, in sort of literary sense, in the aesthetic sense at least, it's primitivism, in that you were very, very close to people, to things happening, you know, to the smells and colours and emotions of those places and those people. It was like a drug, if you like. It sort of switched on his circuits. And the dottiness is there. I mean, British Honduras, Belize, I've been there. It is still very dotty.
I've never been there. I really do want to go now, though. He went to Brazil and he wrote a very famous and important piece of journalism about Brazil. It was called Genocide in Brazil. He wrote this in 1968. And this is really important that we talk about this, because this elevates him to another level where we know that what he was writing, he cared about, and he really felt he was making an impact here. Can you tell us about what he saw and how this changed his life in many ways?
I think what happened was that he had heard of this report about the Indian Protection Service, which was the organization in Brazil which was supposed to look after the rights and territory, the human rights of the Indians, of the tribes, particularly
the indigenous people
of Brazil. The indigenous people in the Amazon and elsewhere. And the Indian Protection Service were shown to be riddled with corruption and allowing landowners to drive people out to kill the indigenous people and so on. And it was on a huge scale. And the report appeared and then disappeared. But Norman read it. And having read it, he knew that there was a story there that could be written about. He knew that he could put some flesh on those bones by going and seeing how far he could get into that territory. And he came back and he wrote 12,000 words for the Sunday Times magazine, which is the longest piece they'd ever published. And it had a huge impact, and it led to the founding of Survival International. And I think Norman regarded it as the most important thing he ever wrote.
He was incredibly proud of it, wasn't it? And this moment for me signifies the fact that he became not an observer, but a real participant, somebody who could make an impact. And I wonder whether you feel that developed later in his writing as well, that he felt he had more of a role to play, that he could draw attention to these unfortunate parts of the world and make us aware of what's going on.
Yes, I think he did. I mean, you know, that reading you had from Naples 44, which was actually written several years after the genocide piece, also shows that. And I think he did. I mean, I think his empathy was always there. But, you know, as he got older, I think it came more to the surface, and he was able, again, he had the maturity to give it literary form without becoming maudlin. Norman placed his feelings and what he thought about things very, very carefully, like a sort of one note in a symphony, and you would remember it because it would reverberate. But he never, as you said, he never overplayed or anything that he wrote.
What were his politics? Did they matter to his writing?
I think his politics were just the politics of the underdog. I don't think he was particularly political in the way that we think of politics ourselves in these islands.
It's interesting you mentioned he was travelling. He died at the age of 95, which is extraordinary, and he was travelling into later life. And one of the people he travelled with is somebody I admire very much and have interviewed myself, Don McCullen, the great photographer, who this year turns 90. And they're similar in a way. They're both restrained observers.
Yes, he started travelling with Don, interestingly, when Don went to Brazil in his wake to take the photographs for that article. And then afterwards, Norman and Don got together and found that they liked each other and started to travel together. And both said that they got a huge amount from each other. They were very good for each other, I think.
When I look back over all that he wrote, 95, well, he was writing for 70 years, I mentioned 15 novels, 20 travel books, and I said the numbers were contested. I actually cannot find the correct number. Hopefully you know, not that it matters, but roughly.
Well, that's roughly right.
It's roughly right.
Yeah.
So as a novelist, as a nonfiction writer, his nonfiction is better known than his novels. What were his novels like and why are they not better known? I haven't read any of them, I've got to admit.
Well, it's really interesting because he was really well regarded as a novelist in the late 50s and 60s. It's called the test of time, I guess. You know, those have sort of fallen by the wayside, whereas the non-fiction has turned out to be something that nobody else can do as well as he can. He was sort of an encyclopedist of the world. If you look at his collected works, it's like an encyclopedia of the world as it exists at its most absurd, its most fantastical, its most colourful, its most adventurous. And I defy anybody to read him and not think, bloody hell, I really want to go somewhere like that and see those things. Which, even to the end of his life, was saying was still possible. All you had to do was turn off the beaten track 5 yards that way or 20 yards that way and you would see something. And I think that's still true.
Well, I have you to be grateful to, because it's thanks to you that I started reading Norman Lewis.
Oh, good.
And I think that a lot of us here have just been really enjoyed reading or rereading him. Hazel, have you got a favourite? Norman Lewis.
Well, I think, you know, boringly perhaps it has to be Naples 44, which I did absolutely adore. But I really enjoyed his journalism, actually, as well, because I just thought it was so brilliant getting underneath, you know, the skin of a country in the way that he does, and just all those things that we've said about him. They're such perfect little, you know, sort of cameos almost of things that just stay with you. So, yes, those are my favourites.
Might I come in there?
Yes,
I just want to say that I think you're absolutely right, and there is nowhere better to see that than in one of the pieces in A Quiet Evening, which is about the California grape picker strike, when President Reagan was governor of California. And Norman, he had by then started to express himself in a kind of an activist way. We haven't talked about his environmentalism, by the way, and he was the first British writer to write about climate change when he was in Latin America in the 70s, early 80s. But that article for the Sunday Times about the grape picker strike in California has exactly that in spades. It's absolutely fascinating. And he got a very rude letter from Governor Reagan as a result of it.
Victory. Gail, do you have a favourite?
Well, obviously Naples 44, which I read when it first came out from Eland in the 80s, made a huge impression on me.
I found it incredibly moving.
Yeah, I think what struck me then, that I suppose being the generation I am, you know, one grew up with a lot of stories about the war which were, you know, sort of heroic and victories and stoicism during the Blitz and all of that. But Naples 44 reveals the effects of war on ordinary people in a really quite horrendous way. That was an eye-opener to me. But I also, Voices of the Old Sea, which again is tragic because this village over 3 years, he goes back each summer and it's destroyed by a storm that destroys a lot of the fishing boats, a virus that destroys the cork trees, and a very enterprising individual who starts to open a hotel, and it's the beginning of the end, really.
I don't think there's a podcast long enough to describe all the great attributes and themes and countries and all the people he met, but this is just wonderful. And so many thanks to Julian Evans for helping us on this journey. It's given me even more I want to read. We have a fantastic list of Norman Lewis titles to put on our reading list, but we also have some more recommendations. So stay tuned, everyone. And thank you very much to Julian Evans for coming.
Thank you, Rosie. It's been a huge pleasure.
Slightly Foxed is a small independent publishing house in Hoxton, East London. It was founded in 2004 by two editors, Gail Perkis and Hazel Wood, as a labour of literary love. Slightly Foxed publishes a quarterly magazine which appeals to passionate readers everywhere who enjoy engaging with a wide range of excellent writing, past and present, fiction and non-fiction. Slightly Foxed champions the lost, lesser-known or forgotten literary gems and celebrates the offbeat and unusual. Its contributors are also an eclectic bunch. Some are well-known novelists, distinguished journalists or academics. Others come from very different walks of life. Slightly Foxed also regularly reissues out-of-print books that deserve new audiences. The quarterly magazine has a global readership and is always happy to welcome more readers. It's posted out four times a year to over 60 countries. You can take out an annual subscription at a very reasonable rate, and this also gives you free access to all the back issues and the whole digital archive. That's well over 1,200 articles. If you'd like to subscribe, do visit our website, foxedquarterly.com, or if you'd prefer to talk to a human being in the office, then phone us in the London office. Contact details are on the website. Today, the Slightly Foxed family comprises magazines, books, newsletters, the annual Reader's Day, and our podcast. Do join us. So here we are back again. Gail and Hazel, you have some further book recommendations for us to add to our list for this quarter. Gail.
Well, I was in Daunce in Marylebone High Street. Not that long ago, and I came across a writer who I confess I'd never heard of before, called Joseph O'Connor.
I can't believe you've never read Joseph O'Connor before.
Many gaps in my education.
I never would have thought it.
Who I discovered by Googling him is the brother of the singer Sinead O'Connor, which again was a revelation. Anyhow, he's written a lot and he's won a lot of awards, but the two particular books, which I've finished one and I'm nearly at the end of the second one, My Father's House, which came out in 2023, and The Ghosts of Rome, which came out last year. And they are set in Rome in 1943, 1944, and they are all about the escape line that tried to rescue Allied servicemen who had either broken out of camps when Italy signed the armistice or they'd been shot down, and they're hidden all over Rome. And there's a group of seven people called the Choir who help them, and they're based in the Vatican. And of course, the Vatican was neutral. And in the first book, My Father's House, an Irish priest has a sort of battle of wits with the head of the Gestapo. And in the second book, an Italian contessa, who's also a member of the Choir, again has a battle of wits. And I haven't found out what happens in this second one. But they are so gripping, they're so fast-paced, and they give such a wonderful picture of Rome and its layer upon layer of history. I mean, they're just gripping.
Thank you so
much. Very
well
written. Joseph O'Connor is Irish, and a delightful Irish lilt to the language, which is a pleasure to read.
Adds to our Italian list for today, Naples, yep. 44, by Norman Lewis. And Hazel, what have you got for us?
Mine's very, very different and very English. I've always been rather keen on Justin Webb, and I listen to him every morning virtually.
Justin Webb, the presenter of the Today programme.
Yes, and this is his autobiography. It's called The Gift of a Radio, and it's about growing up. Well, first of all, he didn't know who his father really was until I think he was in his teens, when he was watching some rather distinguished-looking person announcing something about the balance of payments. And his mother just said, "That's your father," who was called Peter Woods. And he just didn't know what to make about it. But anyway, he grew up with his mother, who was terribly anxious, very loving, but, you know, trying to live with a stepfather who the local GP said was just stark raving mad. He was obviously obsessional in every way. And
the stepfather.
Stepfather. But in a way, Justin, you know, has sympathy for him. But anyway, he was this only child in this very weird situation, rather embarrassed by his parents. It's a sort of picture of the 70s. He was sent to a Quaker boarding school, which weirdly was a sort of hellhole of bullying, drugs, everything really. But he survived it all and came through. And I think it's a very good picture of that period, what it's like to be a kind of only child in a rather difficult situation.
So that's the biography, the autobiography of Justin Webb. Who went on to become a great BBC presenter, in the same way that Norman Lewis also escaped a very difficult childhood,
exactly.
So went on to be a great writer.
Yes, but I enjoyed
fascinating.
It very much.
Fascinating. Thank you very much to Hazel Wood and Gail Perkis, and thank you again to Julian Evans for being our guest, and to Rose Baring for the readings today. And thank you very much to my producer, Philippa Goodridge, and the whole team here at Slightly Foxed. And that's it for this episode. See you in 3 months' time for yet more compelling storytellers and riveting tales. You'll find all the books and authors we've discussed today in the programme show notes, which you can easily access on your podcast app or the Foxed website, foxedquarterly.com. And that's where you can also subscribe to our quarterly print magazine. Print or podcast, all of us at Slightly Foxed are united in our great love of books and of great authors, past and present, in reading the best contemporary literature and in rediscovering lost and forgotten literary gems. My name is Rosie Goldsmith, and thank you for listening.